Hi and welcome to episode 54 of the Guru Performance We Do Science podcast. Today with me is Professor Andy Jones, who's a Professor of Applied Physiology at the University of Exeter. Hi Andy.
Hi Lauren, how's it going?
It's good mate, it's good. So I think sort of the normal way of introducing my guest experts onto this podcast is sort of how this is, I'll sort of let you do the work here. So why don't you just quickly tell the listener about who you are and what your sort of current your research, that you're better known for.
Yeah, sure. Well, you said some of it already. So I'm a professor of applied physiology in the Department of Sport and Health Sciences. I was until recently the head of Department of Sport and Health Sciences here, but I've recently taken on the mantle of Associate Dean for Research in the College of Life and Environmental Sciences. So that means more meetings and more paperwork to read in preparation and all of that stuff. So anyway, so I'm just adapting to that. I guess in terms of sports nutrition, the topic that most of your listeners might be most familiar with is our research on dietary nitrate, or beetroot juice is the vehicle which we've often used in order to get nitrate into people, and the effects that appears to have both on cardiovascular health, resting physiology, and also some exercise performance variables.
Yeah, I because the listener would know this, but I had you come do some lectures for one of the programs I run on the ISSN diploma, and you gave a great lecture on nitric oxide, dietary nitrates and exercise performance, which we're going to talk about today. But you also gave a really fascinating lecture on sort of oxygen kinetics and that sort of thing, which is in fact, it was one of the lectures that I listened to that made me realise just how important it is for us as performance nutritionists, who is not representative of every listener. We've all got all kinds of listeners, but as I've said many a time, I think in order to understand the needs of our clients, our athletes, you need to know more than just sort of the tools of your trade. In my case, nutrition. You need to, in order to perform a needs analysis, that sort of thing. And it was, it's really great to get experts such as yourself, physiologists, to help us understand some of these mechanisms and that we're aiming to manipulate. In my case, through diet. And as Kevin Carroll likes to popularize this sort of idea of unleashing the power of food, this topic, dietary nitrates, I think is a great topic to get into when we consider the power of food, because as we're going to reveal today, dietary nitrates are found in our day-to-day food if we're eating the right kinds of foods. But let's sort of bring this back a bit, because not everyone knows much about dietary nitrates. They certainly probably don't know a whole lot about nitric oxide and that sort of thing. And because we're going to talk primarily about dietary nitrates and performance or exercise performance, I think that's probably what we'll have time for. But it is fair to say that this can be applied to other areas such as general health and cardiovascular health and various other things. But why, Andy, is nitric oxide important for exercise?
Well, nitric oxide is a gaseous physiological signaling molecule, which has a wide variety of different purposes or just different effects in the human body. It's probably best known for its effect in causing dilation of blood vessels. So that's clearly important for directing blood flow and nutrients, including oxygen, to the right areas, including obviously skeletal muscle during exercise. But it's also involved in a whole array of other things, including neurotransmission, muscle contraction, mitochondrial function and mitochondrial efficiency, immune function. There's a whole host of things. I mean, nitric oxide is ubiquitous. It's one of those molecules that we really can't do without, which is why, as we'll come on to discuss, I'm sure there's more than one way by which we can make it. It wasn't known until recently that we had this alternative pathway. But we do know that as people get older or as they become ill for whatever reason, that the ability to produce nitric oxide or the ability to respond to nitric oxide goes down. So one important feature of a healthy functioning individual is the propensity, the ability to generate nitric oxide and to respond to it adequately.
Fantastic. And I mean, I know that this podcast isn't going to be enough time to talk about all the different sort of components of you know, in what ways nitric oxide plays a role in our physiology and biochemistry, and you mentioned about signaling. We've done a number of podcasts with people like Lee Breen and Lee Hamilton, and Keith Barr. You know, I think the listeners, if they've listened to those episodes, and if you haven't listened to them immediately, please, they've got an idea about the importance of signaling. And I think we're starting to get an appreciation for it's not just one thing. It's not just the exercise stimulus. There's a sort of a chain reaction of events that occurs that can positively or negatively influence the adaptations that we're after. And of course, nitric oxide appears to be an important part of that. And I'm trying not to use the word context too many times, because that's sort of my trademark, I think, in this podcast. But sort of, you know, how significant is nitric oxide in the sort of scheme of all this?
I think it's really important. I think, you know, research is only just on the tip of the iceberg, really, with how important these things are. Nitric oxide is the one that we perhaps know most about, but there's a lot of information coming out now that hydrogen sulfide, for example, and carbon monoxide are important signaling molecules as well. And it's all to do with the redox status of the muscle, you know, the oxidant, antioxidant sort of status, and the imbalance that may be caused at the level of the muscle through exercise and its interaction with diet can be really important in initiating those cascades, that chain of events, if you like, within the muscle that leads ultimately to adaptation. So we have this plasticity within the muscle that allows us to adapt to training, and getting the optimal balance between the training and the recovery, the types of overload that we use, and the nutritional support that we provide in order to augment that stimulus. You know, those are absolutely essential, and I think that's what practitioners, whether that's in sports nutrition or sports science physiology, really ought to be helping athletes and coaches with.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, as I've come to learn more about this, I'm excited about the way that various factors can play a role in, well, an integrating role in, you know, the outcomes, and particularly with elite athletes, of course, where even little things can make a big difference. And of course, that's what your research has helped us to see, where there's a value for this. So I guess we shouldn't be talking about nitrates without actually discussing where they even come from. Let's get into that a bit.
Yeah, so I think, you know, you mentioned nitric oxide already as perhaps the key vehicle which may enable some of these effects to occur. And nitric oxide is actually produced in two ways in the body. One is through the oxidation of an amino acid called L-arginine. And that's quite a complicated reaction, actually, and you need oxygen as a substrate and some various other cofactors. But that's the one that's best described, you know. So if we know that we use a family of enzymes called nitric oxide synthase to convert L-arginine into nitric oxide, and you also get L-citrulline produced as a byproduct of that. And the nitric oxide that's produced actually ends up being, it becomes nitrite and nitrate. And it was until recently believed that those were just inert byproducts of the reaction, that they actually served no useful physiological purpose. And it's only really over the last 15 to 20 years that we've realized that the nitrite and nitrate that gets produced in that reaction can actually go in the other direction, if you like, and be reduced back ultimately to nitric oxide. So we're producing nitrite and nitrate endogenously all of the time, but also we can increase the amount of nitrate in our bodies by dietary means. So there are certain foodstuffs that are available that contain quite a lot of inorganic nitrate, and through a relatively straightforward process, we process that nitrate in our bodies first into nitrite, and then we know that that nitrite can be reduced still further to nitric oxide, especially in conditions that are more hypoxic or are more acidic, as of course may well be the case during skeletal muscle during exercise. So this does seem to be a route by which we can increase the availability of nitric oxide. Provided that we eat or consume sufficient nitrate in our diets, then we're able to elevate our plasma nitrite concentration. That whole process, by the way, requires the collaboration, if you like, with bacteria that live in our mouths, and maybe we can explore that in a minute. And then that nitrite that's elevated can become nitric oxide, which may be beneficial to enabling the appropriate amount of oxygen to be supplied to muscle tissue, but simultaneously it appears to be acting on muscle cells. Now, we don't know at the moment whether that's just on the mitochondria, which seems to make them a little bit more efficient, or on the contractile process, making the actual generation of energy, generation of force, more efficient per amount of ATP consumed. So, but the sorts of foodstuffs that contain a lot of nitrate are essentially the green leafy vegetables. So, you know, lettuce is one, spinach, rocket, various herbs like parsley as well. Beetroot contains quite a bit as well. So it's those that seem to be important. And of course, they're part of the so-called five-a-day diet that governments in this country and actually around the world are recommending to us for our cardiovascular health. And some of the meta-analyses indicate that it does tend to be the green leafy vegetables as opposed to the fruits, for example, that you know, not saying that fruits aren't important as well, but the green leafy vegetables do seem to be particularly important. We do know that if you consume a lot of nitrate, whether that's naturally by consuming a vegetarian type diet or eating, you know, this in the States, there's a thing called the DASH diet, which involves quite a lot of high nitrate vegetables, that your blood pressure goes down at rest. And it can be by quite a dramatic amount. And over an entire sort of human sort of population, if you can reduce blood pressure by just 3 millimeters of mercury, and you can get much larger effects than that actually if you take a supplement, you know, high nitrate supplement such as beetroot juice, then that would massively reduce the incidence of strokes and heart attacks. So across the lifespan and across the human population, there are very important health consequences of consuming a high nitrate diet, but that's separate from some of the performance effects that we may see in people who exercise regularly also.
Yeah, I mean, that, you know, I think this is exciting on a number of levels, but the main one being that there is actually a performance benefit to eating vegetables. Yeah. And it's funny, I've said this on various podcasts before, for all the rocket science we get to talk about and listen to from experts such as yourself, on the applied end of the spectrum, which I work in, you know, it can be challenging sometimes to get athletes to actually eat vegetables or even know what a vegetable looks like. And, you know, that's a sort of another topic in itself. But I think it's fair to say that you've mentioned a few foods there, you know, various greens and beets and so on, which most people are having, maybe not enough, certainly not five a day, but certainly there's a presence of this sort of raw material, if you like, that's present in people's diets before you even consider supplementation. But what I find particularly interesting is when I'm reading the research, and in your research, particularly your relatively recent review you did on dietary nitrate supplementation and exercise performance, which I think was, what paper was it? It was sports medicine, sports, wasn't it? Medicine. Yeah. So you talk about this importance of nitric oxide bioavailability by augmenting nitrite and nitric oxide pathways. That seems to me to be something that is particularly fascinating. Is that what you're alluding to then in where we're going in terms of research and how we can maybe develop strategies to enhance the bioavailability?
Yes, that's exactly it. Yeah. Now, the interesting thing, though, is that we and others have done some studies recently in various clinical disease conditions, you know, and the effect of nitrate supplementation doesn't seem to be as large as we or others had hoped. Mm. And it seems to be that in some situations, just having the ability to produce nitric oxide isn't enough. It seems that you also have to be able to respond to it. So there's bioavailability and bioactivity. Those are two kind of slightly different things. But it does appear that if you're in a situation where you're not generating enough nitric oxide, then changing your diet or supplementing with something like beetroot juice might enable you to produce more nitric oxide and to, you know, enjoy some of the benefits thereof.
Yeah, I really like this idea that not only are we engaging in sort of physical training strategies and periodizing them, etc., to, you know, augment or bring about certain adaptations, and there are obviously different strategies to use at different times, but there's this idea now that we can actually eat, you know, eat different foods at different times, if you like, periodize our eating, also to help train our physiology, our biochemistry, and so on. And I think that we're sort of, well, we're not just arrived there, obviously. We've talked about carbohydrate cycling or periodization, which is not an entirely new concept, but with people like Trent Stellingworth, we've talked about, you know, the various ways in which carbohydrate manipulation can have some very interesting adaptation responses in the body, which I also got into with John Hawley and James Morton. But it's not just macronutrients or substrates, it can be nitrates. It's fascinating. And do you feel that this is just the tip of the iceberg, though?
In terms of nitrate or just
obviously we're talking about nitrate and we're going to get into that a bit more, but do you feel that this is sort of just the start of what we're going to discover about these things?
I certainly think that what we I think our knowledge of the interaction between nutritional components and the adaptation to training is still pretty rudimentary. I think a lot more could be done there in terms of the timing of both macro and micronutrients pre-post exercise, different types of exercise, different rest recovery pathways, and so on. I don't think we know enough at the moment. That said, I think we probably know 90%, 95% of the stuff that's important. I think there's a propensity in coaching and in science to sort of overcomplicate both training and nutrition, but that doesn't mean to say that I don't think there's a lot more that could be discovered to actually eke a little bit more, you know, out of an athlete's training in order to elicit greater performance gains.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I do find that, you know, we do forget sometimes that our job sometimes is to make our clients or our athletes' lives simpler, not more complicated. And I guess there's that recognition of how important is this strategy, really, you know. And that's why we need to know about the mechanisms and the evidence behind that, so that we can make that sort of balanced decision about, is this something we really want to do?
But you know, just to go back to one of the things we were talking about earlier, I think ultimately a lot of it is about consistency, and it's about common sense, and it's about simplifying things as much as possible. You know, you can spend 23 hours a day thinking about what your next training session should be, but the most important thing is that you do it, or that you do something, and that you're able to do that most days, if not every day, in order that you develop that kind of... I think it's an accruement of training stimuli, really, that lead to the adaptation. And it's the same with diet and nutrition. It's making sure that you eat most of the right things most of the time, as frequently as is optimal, you know. And I think things like supplementation, or having some kind of crazy newfangled training schedule, is at best the icing on the cake, isn't it? It's just sometimes it can add a little bit, but you've got to have that that substantial cake there in terms of the appropriate training volume and intensity, and eating essentially that, you know, a good balanced diet is such an obvious thing to say, and I'm sure you've heard plenty of other people say the same thing, but it does I think it is necessary just to underline that point.
No, you're right. And you know, despite it doesn't matter how many times we say this, that message constantly needs to be reinforced, because it is mastering the basics in a consistent manner that has the biggest impact. And, you know, if you don't like that type of cake, they're just, well, you're not going to eat it, are you? So, anyway, it's enough about cakes, Andy.
Yeah, we're not talking cakes today.
No. Well, yeah, beetroot cake, maybe. Nitrate reduces the oxygen cost of exercise and improves exercise tolerance, as you say in one of your papers there. Can you tell us a bit more about this importance of why we want to reduce the oxygen cost of exercise, and how that relates to nitrates?
Yeah, and actually that gives me a chance just to go back to one of the things you said in the introduction, which is to do with my background being more in physiology. than in nutrition. And the thing that attracted me to investigate dietary nitrate in the first place was an early study that I came across in the literature, which indicated just short-term dietary nitrate supplementation. And they actually used nitrate salt, sodium nitrate, rather than a natural product such as beetroot juice, that the 3 days of supplementation reduced the oxygen cost of exercise. And as a respiratory physiologist by background, that really intrigued me, because there's virtually nothing that will really change the oxygen cost of exercise. On a cycle ergometer, then the basic equation is 10 mils of oxygen per minute per watt above your resting metabolic rate. So if you're exercising at 200, if your change in work rate on a cycle ergometer is 200 watts, you'd expect a 2 liter per minute rise in VO2. And that seems to be essentially the same irrespective of age and training status and, you know, pre-test diet and everything else. It's immutable is the word. It's something that just doesn't really change very readily. So to find that an acute dietary intervention lowered the oxygen cost of exercise, in other words, made muscle more efficient, was really quite a dramatic finding, and one that I didn't honestly expect to be able to reproduce. And when we were able to do that quite consistently using beetroot juice as an intervention, that really became quite exciting. And again, as someone who's interested in athletic performance, so as well as my sort of respiratory exercise physiology background, I am interested in sports performance physiology, especially in endurance sports. I was of the view that, you know, that could, as long as everything else remained equal, that could actually translate into improved performance. And the original paper that I saw, which had used sodium nitrate, hadn't investigated performance at all. So in our first few studies, we were also keen to investigate whether the improved muscle efficiency did actually translate into improved performance. And we found that it did, at least in those, you know, not sedentary, but not particularly well-trained individuals in our early studies. But to answer your question directly, the reason it's important is that if your VO2 max is the same, and your lactate threshold is the same, these are two of the most important characteristics of high-level endurance performance, then a lower oxygen cost for the same external work rate or same running speed will mean that you're operating at a lower fraction of your VO2 max. You know, let's say, for example, you might be only going at 82% of your VO2 max, whereas without the nitrate, you might have been at 85%. And that means that you're going to fatigue less rapidly, essentially. You'll accumulate less of the things that we think cause you to slow down. So, you know, lower oxygen costs, higher muscle efficiency is a really important aspect of performance right across the spectrum of human activities, in fact.
Yeah, I'm pleased you went into it in the detail that you did, because it's important that we understand why this is relevant to those of us that are working with people that are active. But perhaps you could clarify on what's the spectrum here that we're referring to in terms of significance, and by that I mean real world significance. I mean, are we talking sort of, you know, a weekend warrior is going to notice a major difference here, or are we talking more on the elite spectrum?
I think a lot of this still needs to be investigated. So, you know, if you really do have an improved muscle efficiency, then that could be important if you're an older person trying to climb a flight of stairs or meander down to the local shop. The energy cost of that activity will be less. And potentially it could mean an activity being achievable when previously it wasn't. So at that non-athletic side of the spectrum, then that could have some applications there. You know, we and others are investigating that. In terms of athletes, whether they're just recreational or elite, then there does seem to be some disparity in the literature about that. It looks like, as you say, the weekend warrior does appear to benefit more than the very, very highly trained elite athlete. And there's all sorts of reasons why that may be the case. Not least that the elite athlete, because they're actually expending more energy, will also be having a greater dietary intake. And that presumably includes more nitrate-containing foods as well. So they may already be taking in more nitrate than the average person, and therefore may not benefit to the same extent from any additional supplementation of the diet.
Sure.
But also, you know, their muscles will be better oxygenated, and I've mentioned already that nitrite is only reduced to nitric oxide when you've got a hypoxic environment. there's some evidence that type 2 muscle fibers, fast twitch muscle fibers, may be more sensitive to nitrate and to nitrite than our slow twitch fibers. So if you're a very well trained endurance athlete, then arguably you might benefit to less extent. Your mitochondria may be more efficient from the type of training that you've done, so that potential mechanism might not be there either. So there have been a few studies in really well trained individuals who show that at least when you give the standard dose of nitrate, whether that's just acutely or over a few days, doesn't have the same effect. It isn't quite as potent as we've reported previously in lesser trained individuals. That said, it does appear to be the case that there are some elite athletes who do still benefit. I mean, there was a study from the Australian Institute of Sport with the first author, I think it's Pete Peeling, and they had, I think, that there was two studies within the same paper, but they were looking at six and then five of their very best kayakers, Olympic standard kayakers. And in the laboratory, all six of them had a lower oxygen cost of kayaking, and in the field, all five of them improved their performance. Now, whether that's something to do with upper body rather than lower body exercise, I'm not sure. A couple of studies, one by Jens Bangsbo's group and one with Lawrence Spreet in cyclists and runners respectively, didn't show a significant benefit of dietary nitrate supplementation at the group level, but nevertheless they identified that 20 to 25% of the athletes that they tested did respond positively, really quite consistently. So there is this responder, non-responder issue that we need to get to the bottom of as well. So not everybody seems to benefit, but you know, a relatively high fraction, albeit a minority, still do benefit. And certainly anecdotally, a lot of athletes do still seem to think it works for them. The other important thing, and I sort of alluded to this as part of my earlier answer, is I said when you give them the standard dose, what we don't know at the moment is whether if you give elite athletes more than the standard dose, whether they might stand to benefit to a greater extent. But it is fascinating how, you know, you give a certain number of people exactly the same amount of dietary nitrate, and their ability to convert that into nitrite seems to differ quite substantially between people. And then whether or not that actually impacts upon exercise economy, in other words, the oxygen cost of exercise, and performance seems to vary as well. What we do find is that if nitrate reduces the oxygen cost of submaximal exercise, then it also seems to benefit performance. But if the first thing doesn't happen, then the second doesn't happen either.
Sure. So obviously, I mean, there's a great deal of sort of inter-individual variability, as there is with so many things, and us as practitioners need to bear that in mind, of course. And I guess there's all kinds of things that are going to play a role here. Obviously, the habitual diet, as I mentioned before, athletes, you know, they're not renowned necessarily for eating a bunch of vegetables and that sort of thing. That surely plays a role. So obviously that sort of introduces the concept of beyond diet, the sort of supplementation of this. And I guess before we go down that path in more detail, I mean, we often associate this with beetroot. And you've already made it clear, it's not just beetroot that, you know, that we get this from. There's all kinds of things in our diet generally associated with sort of the healthy veg that we should all be trying to eat plenty of. But I mean, why did you go down the beetroot path for this?
Well, one of the reasons is that it's actually quite easy to quantify the amount of nitrate in beetroot juice in a liquid as compared to a solid. And, you know, to my knowledge, you can't buy or produce spinach juice or lettuce juice or anything like that. If you could, then that would be just as good. I mean, you know, we've done studies because we've got a placebo now where we give people beetroot juice, which has had the nitrate removed from it, and that doesn't have anything like the same effect. So it doesn't mean to say there may not be some interactions between nitrate and the other components of beetroot juice, but you've got to have nitrate. So if you took nitrate in any other form, theoretically it should have the same effect. So, you know, it's simply the fact that it's easier for a start for people to consume liquid compared to a solid, and also it's easy to measure the nitrate content in a liquid compared to a solid as well. So if you want to give people a certain amount of nitrate, then it makes sense that they drink a certain volume of a fluid that you know the concentration of nitrate in. The trouble with the solids, you know, so if we're, you know, I think we ought to be encouraging individuals whether they're athletes or non-athletes, to eat more green leafy vegetables anyway, just for basic cardiovascular health. But actually, you don't know how much nitrate a given lettuce, let's say, has. There was a nice study I saw presented at a conference last year, which looked at lettuces, I think, and various other vegetables bought off the shelf in various supermarkets across the US. And it was absolutely vastly different, you know, tenfold differences in the amount of nitrate in a given lettuce or whatever. So you just, it really does depend upon the growing conditions, where the vegetable was grown, the time of year in which it was grown, how long it took to appear on the shelf, what you do with it once you buy it, all of that. So while on average, some of the vegetables that I mentioned contain a lot of nitrate, you never quite know how much they've got. So only by giving them, in this, you know, we use beetroot juice because we knew that originally giving them half a litre of beetroot juice contained about 5.5 millimoles of nitrate. And there are various companies now that obviously make concentrated versions. So a 70 mil shot of beetroot juice now can contain as much as 8 millimoles of nitrate. So that's quite an efficient way to get quite a bit of nitrate in with minimum effort.
Sure.
Simple as that.
Yeah. No, I know. You know, I appreciate that from you as a researcher, you've got to be able to, you know, control lots of variables and all kinds of stuff. And it's very, particularly when you're trying to create some placebos and that sort of thing, you know, I can imagine it's not easy to do with a stack of lettuce or something. But
And the other point is, yeah, actually that you'd need to eat actually quite a lot of vegetables to get, you know, the right amount of nitrate.
Yeah, I'm pleased because that was my next question, is just so listeners can, you know, view this, because naturally they're going to be going, well, I'd rather just eat my vegetables. I mean, so what are we talking? I mean, how, you know, of things like, I don't know, spinach or some greens, I mean, just how much chomping are we going to have to do?
Well, so I mentioned just now that you never quite know how much it contains.
Yeah.
But the usual analogy is that sort of, I think 5 or 6 millimoles of nitrate is about equivalent to about 300 grams of spinach.
Wow.
So it's not impossible. But, you know, 300 grams of spinach is really an entire bag worth, isn't it? You know, you'd have to munch quite a bit of it, I think.
Yeah.
And in terms of the number of beetroots, well, if you've got a particularly high nitrate beetroot, you might only need to eat about 3 medium-sized ones. So it's not impossible, but again, if you haven't got as much in there as you'd hope, it might be more like 6 or 8 of them, and that could lie kind of heavily on the stomach.
Yeah. So I think what we're hearing then is, and we'll go back into mechanisms a bit, but there's clearly a role for this in performance, and despite the fact that it is naturally available in the diet, and even if you are able to eat a diet 5 or even 10 servings of veggies a day, that does seem to come from maybe the better sources of nitrate, it's unlikely that we're going to achieve an optimal intake for performance, and therefore over and above a good diet, whatever that is, there is definitely still a place and a rationale for supplementation.
Yeah, and I think in part that's to do with the time course as well. So if you ate some nitrate containing vegetables several times per day, you know, that's all well and good, and I think we ought to be recommending that occur, but it probably won't, it will elevate the plasma nitrate to a certain amount and kind of keep it stable over time. But, you know, we've acted on the premise that the biggest performance effects are likely to occur when plasma nitrite peaks, and that peak seems to be related to the amount of nitrate that you take and when you take it. So if you take, you know, let's say eight millimoles of nitrate, maybe a shot or two of commercially available concentrated beetroot juice, you'll find that plasma nitrite peaks at about 2 to 2.5 hours after you do that. So, you know, that's what we've been recommending that athletes do, and that's been the protocol that we've used in all our studies. Is that if you want to supplement, then you should supplement about 2 to 3 hours before you're due to exercise, because that will guarantee that you are exercising while plasma nitrite is substantially elevated. After you've taken that bolus of nitrate, the plasma nitrite, so as I've mentioned, it peaks after 2 to 3 hours, but then will gradually fall with time. Still remains reasonably high sort of 6 hours later, but certainly within 12 to 24 hours, it's back down to baseline. So if you want to, you know, compete in a race on the Sunday morning, it would be no good really having a high nitrate meal on the Saturday night or the Saturday lunchtime, because your plasma nitrite will be pretty, you know, will be reverting back to baseline values by then. So it will be a case of trying to top up, as it were, or take a particularly large stimulus sort of thing a couple of hours before you're due to race.
Sure. Yeah, well, in a bit, when we get towards the end of the podcast, we'll get more into the sort of practical applications of this, which we've delved into a bit there. But I mean, I want to go back a bit more into some of the mechanisms, and it's partly for my own selfish reasons. I'm sort of really interested in the role that dietary nitrates can have on substrate utilization, so things like carbohydrate and fat usage, that sort of thing. I mean, what's the relationship there?
Yeah, it's a good question. Well, it first of all, we do know that nitric oxide is involved in muscle glucose uptake. So that's, you know, when we were going through some of the various roles that nitric oxide plays, that was one that I remembered later that I'd forgotten to list. But it is involved, you know, very, very importantly in making sure that muscle can take up glucose appropriately. But when we do our studies, we really don't find that the respiratory exchange ratio, which reflects muscle substrate utilization, changes to any appreciable extent, certainly not significantly. There's an indication in some studies that it may be a little bit higher, so it may be driving you a little bit more towards carbohydrate and away from fat, which in terms of efficiency is actually quite a good thing. But that doesn't seem to be the main mechanism by which we get this lower oxygen uptake.
Okay. And there's, I mean, you mentioned mitochondrial efficiency. Because people, they're having their own ideas what they mean. You know, use the word efficiency, that can be misinterpreted a bit. As it relates to mitochondrial efficiency, what are you referring to?
Well, what you really want to do is, what the mitochondria are there for is obviously to produce energy aerobically through so-called oxidative phosphorylation. And essentially their role is to rephosphorylate ADP, adenosine diphosphate. And essentially they use oxygen to produce the energy to add another phosphate bond to ADP to make it ATP. So when we talk about mitochondrial efficiency, it's the ratio between the amount of phosphor, it's what we call the P2O ratio. It's the amount of oxygen required to rephosphorylate ADP, basically. And there was a study done by a group in Scandinavia which showed that when they'd fed people dietary nitrate and taken a muscle biopsy, that the mitochondria that was harvested from those biopsy samples were more efficient. The P2O ratio of the mitochondria was lower, it was costing less oxygen. And in fact, the people who demonstrated the greatest reduction in oxygen uptake during cycle exercise were those that had the greatest change in mitochondrial P2O ratio. So that study seemed to indicate that mitochondria were impacted by nitrate supplementation. But, you know, there's an alternative view to that as well, and some of the work that we did doesn't indicate that mitochondrial efficiency changes are necessary for the lower oxygen uptake that we and others have reported.
Okay, now it's fascinating, and also I also read in various studies that there appears to be some impact on this on just sort of the contractile functions of muscle. Could you take us into that a bit?
Yeah, so again, in order to produce a given amount of force, we typically need a certain split rate at which we split ATP to produce the energy. And there was a study done again in Scandinavia at the Karolinska Institute, which indicated that various muscle proteins were changed as a consequence of nitrate supplementation. This was in a mouse model, though, rather than in humans so far. And it did indicate that for a given stimulation frequency, this is electrical stimulation of animal muscle, that more force was produced. And they were able to link that to changes in calcium handling proteins. So we know that when calcium is released from the sarcoplasmic reticulum, that's what causes muscle to contract. So there seemed to be some change in muscle's ability to handle calcium, and this impacted upon force transduction. So there do seem to be some effects there. The study that we did in humans was in our magnet, so we're able to interrogate muscle metabolism non-invasively, so we don't have to take muscle biopsies, but we can look at what happens to ADP, inorganic phosphate, pH, in real time as muscle contracts. And what we found there was that the actual ATP turnover rate for a given work rate during a knee extension exercise in the magnet was less when people had been supplemented with nitrate compared to placebo. So, you know, that indicated that changes in mitochondrial efficiency weren't necessary. You could have the same mitochondrial efficiency if the actual demand for ATP to be split to generate a given amount of force or work, or work rate, sorry, or power, is altered, then actually you don't need to hypothesize any changes in mitochondrial efficiency. So there do seem to be effects on muscle contractile function as well. Some of that may be related to contraction frequency or contraction speed as well. There have been some studies recently which indicate that nitrate may be more effective at high compared to low pedal rates, for example. And that again points towards maybe fast twitch fibers involvement in this whole process. The other mechanism, just to kind of round it all off, is one that was explored by David Poole and his colleagues in Kansas State University. And this was a rat study. But what they did was they fed their rats beetroot juice for about 6 days. And they've got this really nice technique where they're able to document, if you like, where the blood flow goes. They're able to measure total blood flow to the hind limb of the rats, but they're also able to determine within the hind limb, you know, which muscles has that most of that oxygen been directed towards. And first of all, there was a really large increase in blood flow to muscle. So it may be that the vasodilation that we know occurs with nitric oxide enables more flow to the tissues, but intriguingly, they found that the majority of the increased blood flow to the leg muscles of the rats was going to those muscle groups that have a high proportion of type 2 or fast twitch fibers, which of course traditionally, you know, would be expected to be those that are underperfused with oxygen. So this seems to be a route or a means by which the body can direct more oxygen to the areas that need it most. So there's potentially three mechanisms which might actually all be happening in synchrony. Changes in mitochondrial efficiency is one, changes in contractile function is another, and an appropriate distribution of blood flow and oxygen to areas that need it most is a third.
No, thank you. So, I mean, clearly there are important intracellular and extracellular effects that are going on here, and you've made it quite clear there's some sort of integration that's going on here, and it's clearly important for a variety of performance functions. But also, as I mentioned at the beginning, we're not just talking about performance, though, are we? We're also looking at a variety of health impacts of this, and I've mentioned this many times on this podcast, but even if we are thinking about athletes are humans first, and you know, I think you can't ever want to ignore the health implications of this. So what it's not the point of this podcast to go into all of the health sides of this, but could you give us just a quick overview?
Well, it's I did sort of mention this a little bit earlier, but it's really the blood pressure effect. So one of the actually before anybody got on to the potential effects of nitrate on exercise physiology or performance, people were looking at nitrate in the diet and its effect on blood pressure, and it's pretty well documented. You know, there are umpteen studies in the literature now which show that if you feed people nitrate, whether it's in a chemical form or in a dietary nutritional form, the blood pressure really falls quite a bit, and the more hypertensive you are, the higher your blood pressure at rest, the more it comes down by. So it's a natural means by which high blood pressure could be controlled. So it could be a way to prevent blood pressure going up as we get older. One thing that's going to be really quite interesting to find out is the way by which older people are able to process nitrate in their diet. So I mentioned very briefly earlier on, and I wouldn't mind just saying a bit more about this, that the bacteria that live in our mouths are really important in this whole process. We know, for example, that if you take mouthwash and kill those bacteria, that your ability to convert nitrate in your diet into nitrite in your blood is completely obliterated. So, you know, public health enemy number one, in a sense, could be considered to be these antibacterial mouthwashes that quite a lot of people take, especially in the US, interestingly. So, you know, that shows you how symbiotic this relationship is between the bacteria that we... It's the same in our gut. You know, these guys live in our mouths and in our intestinal tract for a very good reason. They benefit from residing in those places, and we benefit from it as well. And it may be that the population of bacteria that live in people's oral cavities, whether they're athletes or whether, you know, whether this changes with older age or with the type of diet that you have, is really important in the efficiency with which we can convert nitrate in our diet into nitrite in our bodies and into nitric oxide in order to enjoy some of these potential physiological benefits. In our first beetroot juice study, where we gave half a litre of normal beetroot juice that contained about 5.5 millimoles of nitrate, we found that resting blood pressure fell by, on average, this is systolic blood pressure, fell by 7 millimetres of mercury. Wow. It's really quite a substantial amount, and diastolic down by about 2 or 3. So you get really big effects on resting blood pressure, and we do know that, you know, high blood pressure is a definite risk factor when it comes to heart attacks and strokes. There was an item in the news just this week, I think, about, you know, youngish working age men suffering from the incidence of stroke has gone up really quite markedly this year compared to previous years. And it may be a sedentary lifestyle, too much time spent at the desk, too high calorie diet, all of that stuff, you know, the obesity epidemic. But people are getting high blood pressure earlier, and they're suffering strokes as a result. So one of the things that you can do is obviously alter your diet. Don't take antibacterial mouthwashes, and take more exercise and eat just better generally.
Yeah. It's funny, my grandma told me that. I mean, it is funny, isn't it, how some of these just really sensible things that have been passed down from generation to generation, which obviously now must include the need to be cautious with mouthwashes. But I mean, actually, I'm pleased you talked about the bacteria thing. I've got an expert coming on very soon to talk about the importance of... the microbiome and gut bacteria and so on as it relates to performance, and some recent studies and reviews that have been done on that. But it is fair to say that we are starting to see the importance of not just isolating one strategy on its own. I know you have to do that in the lab, but in the real world, we need to bear in mind there's a number of things that need to be in place. And like you say, you know, if an athlete maybe has some dental hygiene or oral hygiene issues and is constantly rinsing their mouth with whatever, you know, product that they're using, that could result in a negative impact on performance by having a negative impact on this sort of nitric oxide thing. So we as practitioners need to think not just on sort of the isolated sort of strategy that we're going to get them to do, but what are the things that might negatively impact those strategies, which is hard, isn't it? I mean, it's really hard.
Yeah, and some of these things that you, at face value, you might expect to be kind of good for your health may not be. I think any disruption to our normal system, you know, to our microbiome, whether that's gut or mouth, is could potentially be deleterious to us.
Absolutely.
I think, as I was saying, you know, I think there's a lot more to be done there in terms of which populations reside in people and how we go about, you know, harnessing or actually encouraging those bacteria. Because it may be that no matter how good your diet or how good your supplementation regimen, you simply won't get the full benefit from it if you don't have the right bacteria.
Yeah.
And it's probably the same with other forms of nutrition, sports nutrition or otherwise, you know, not necessarily the mouth microbiome, but across the whole gastrointestinal tract, making sure you've got the right characters there, as it were, to help you process the foodstuffs is going to be really essential, and it's something that we really don't know enough about at the moment.
No, I agree, and I think a basic analogy, which is an oversimplification, of course, is that, you know, just because you throw logs into the fireplace doesn't mean that suddenly you've got a healthy fire. You've still got to light it, you've got to open the flue, you need a flow of air, all that, you know, those basic things need to be in place in order for that, in that case, that substrate, if you like, to actually do its job. So listen, so, you know, just to summarise a few of the things then. So it's quite clear then that dietary nitrate appears to be able to reduce blood pressure, lower the oxygen cost of exercise, and maybe even enhance exercise capacity. And, you know, I would imagine we'll learn more and more from this, and you'll be doing more research, of course, on this, and other labs will. But just from a practical perspective then, and I know you've delved a little bit into this, I mean, whether the listeners are looking to optimize this for themselves or for their athletes or clients or whatnot, what are the practical considerations you think we should be taking into account?
I think it's going to be important to consider the timing of the ingestion of nitrate, and as I mentioned a little bit earlier on, you know, making sure that you finish your supplementation regimen with some intake 2 to 3 hours before you compete is important. That seems to be especially, you know, in hypoxia, this seems to be important as well, and that's perhaps a topic for another time. The debate is whether if you take it for a week or so, do you get more bang for your buck than if you just take it acutely? And I think you probably do. I would recommend that athletes probably take nitrate for a few days at least beforehand. I mean, there do seem to be some acute effects, like I've just mentioned, in certain circumstances. But there are studies that show that you do get beneficial muscle protein changes if you take it for a longer period of time. Now, you're not going to get an immediate hit just after 2 or 3 hours. You're going to have to give that several days at least, I think, to see that sort of benefit. So it's probably better to go for at least 2 or 3 days, possibly 5 days out. You know, a couple of shots per day, one in the morning, one in the evening perhaps, but then making sure that you get sufficient 2 to 3 hours before you're due to compete. One interesting question is whether this could be something that could benefit training. You know, should you actually take it every day? Because if you can lower the oxygen cost more chronically, then you could actually get more work done for the same effort. So that could, again, in principle, result in greater training adaptation. But of course, the adaptation to training is so vast, and the added advantage of using nitrate is bound to be relatively small, that could be kind of lost in the noise. So it's a very difficult question to address. So that's important. The amount that you take is going to be crucial as well. And we don't know enough about this at the moment, but you would certainly imagine, for the most part, that more is a little bit better. But I'm not saying that you should use, you know, overdose on this all of the time, by any means. And I think if you're a bigger person, if you're a heavyweight male rower, you probably need to take more. A rugby player, you might need to take more than if you're a female endurance runner, for example. So that's going to be a crucial consideration as well. I did mention rugby there, and it actually is worth mentioning, I think, that this is something that could actually be beneficial for team sport athletes, those doing high-intensity intermittent activities, as much as, if not more so, than endurance athletes competing over, you know, a mile to a marathon. We've done a couple of studies recently which shows that when we either do the yo-yo test, which is a test that mimics what happens during football and rugby and hockey and so on, that you can improve the total amount of work done. That was quite a bit of nitrate that those subjects took over a few days before they actually did the yo-yo test, but there were performance benefits. And we've also simulated an entire hockey match on a cycle ergometer, where we did a series of sprints and recovery intervals that match the sort of work rest profiles that you see during that type of activity. And we also did simultaneous cognitive function tests. So what we found was that the sprint performance was improved by nitrate, especially in the first half, but the cognitive performance was also improved by nitrate, but especially in the second half. So what we found in the control condition, and this has been shown in many previous studies as well, is that the reaction time to cognitive stimuli goes slower, you know, and we were able to reproduce that finding in the control or placebo condition in this recent experiment that we published. But when they took nitrate containing beetroot juice, the active component, we found that they were able to continue to respond with the same accuracy just as quickly in the second half as they did in the first. So there may be, when we talk about performance, I think we don't just mean physical performance necessarily, it's the whole ability, isn't it, to perform appropriately under pressure. And we do know that typically as you become physically fatigued, your ability to make correct and speedy decisions becomes impaired. And there are recent indications, the study that I mentioned from our lab, but I've seen abstracts from other places, which seem to suggest that cognitive function and possibly cerebral blood flow, blood flow to key areas of the brain, is enhanced by nitrate as well. So I think that's going to be a new area. You know, maybe we've been looking in the wrong places, and the athletes that may actually benefit most are your football players and rugby players and hockey players and lacrosse players and netball players and so on.
No, that would be, yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing the research, and I'm sure that will be happening at some point in the near future. So, listen, I know there's more to this topic, and of course, I would urge the listeners to read your papers and other papers that are out there. How do they find out more about you and your you know, your research? And you also have Twitter, I know, but do you have a website at Exeter?
I do. I wouldn't be, I mean, if you look me up, Andrew Jones at Exeter University, you'll find various bits of information, I'm sure. But yeah, I think Twitter is actually a really good vehicle, isn't it? So my Twitter handle, if you like, is at Andy Beetroot, so pretty memorable. And I do tweet quite regularly on all things related to exercise physiology and sports nutrition, performance mainly, but also a bit on health. And of course, I'm very interested in making sure that any new studies that we do on nitrate, amongst other, you know, topics, get a good airing on Twitter. So if people are interested in this topic, then I'd urge them to follow me on Twitter. I'm very keen to expand my portfolio of followers.
No, excellent. Yes, and you're not just into making humans faster. You've also got a bit of an obsession for fast cars. I can tell from your Twitter. Maybe you'll be putting some beetroot into your fuel tank. So,
well, you can buy nitro petrol now, can't you? So maybe it's all interrelated after all.
All right. Yeah, could be. So anyway, Andy, look, thank you very much for your time. It's been fascinating, as expected. I look forward to talking to you again about this stuff at some point in the future when there's a bit more of an update on the topic. But I, of course, am Laurent Bannock, and that brings us to the end of this podcast, number 54, I think. I should have been taking some beetroot. My mind is already starting to lose it. You can learn more about the podcast at guruperformance.com, as well as our various educational programs and so on. So, yes, thank you, Andy, for your time.
Always a pleasure, Laurent.
Okay, take care.
Cheers, bye.